This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's my considerable pleasure to welcome everybody to the sixth Clark Kerr Lectures, which is what these are. It is also my pleasure to say a few words about Clark Kerr, the gentleman you see on the cover of Time magazine here. And I will do that before Provost Steele introduces this year's lecture. Incidentally, is there anyone other than I who remembers this magazine coming out when it first appeared? I do. Don remembers. Okay. So Clark Kerr was certainly one of the very major forces in higher education during the past century. And among many things, he was the first chancellor of the Berkeley campus when the post of chancellor was created. He then succeeded Robert Gordon Sproul as president of the University of California. He defined the role of chancellor because there wasn't a definition when he came in. And he designed and accomplished the organization of the entire University of California in the form that we know it today. He was indeed the guiding force behind the California Master Plan, which I believe is what this cover was about, the Master Plan for Higher Education. That has stood the test of time for nearly 55 years, although it's getting a little ragged here and there. And it has enabled higher education in California and the University of California to be world leaders. Kerr himself was a deep thinker about higher education and also one for memorable quips. After leaving the presidency of the university the same way as he entered, fired with enthusiasm, as he said, Kerr undertook leadership of the Carnegie Commission on Higher Education, which then turned into the Carnegie Council for Policy Studies in Higher Education. There he led the studies and many publications, including an extensive book series, that remain the most definitive studies on higher education still today. He continued to write and speak on higher education for the remainder of his life. It's very fitting that the two organizations most closely associated with Clark Kerr, and they are the University of California and the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which spurred the Carnegie Commissions, that these two organizations have joined together to create and sponsor the Clark Kerr Lectures on the role of the university in society. The lectures are given every 2 years by leading persons from the world of higher education, chosen by a select committee assembled from within the University of California. I now turn the podium over to our Executive Vice Chancellor and Provost, Claude Steele, who will introduce this year's Clark Kerr Lecturer. Claude?
Thank you, Judd. Welcome, everybody. It is a great pleasure to introduce the 2014 Clark Kerr Lecturer, Simon Margenson, Professor of International Higher Education at the Institute of Education in London. It is an honor and a pleasure to have you with us today for this first of the series of three lectures. Professor Margenson is a distinguished scholar of great depth and breadth. A central accomplishment of his work has been to bring an international and comparative approach and perspective to a wide range of topics involving university systems, policy, and organization. For example, over the last 10 years, he has extensively research such interesting and timely topics as the globalization in higher education, the impact of university rankings and international competition, and the global strategies of leading Asian-Pacific research universities across 18 countries in the region. His work, his most recent work, deals with problems of equality, freedom, and creativity, and public universities' role in creating good the public good. The author co-author of dozens of books, articles, reports, and scholarly studies, he is one of the world's most frequently cited researchers in the area of international higher education. He serves as joint editor-in-chief of Higher Education, the leading international journal in the field, and as a member of 15 other editorial boards. Previous to his appointment to the University of London's Institute of Education, Morganson was for many years a faculty member at the University of Melbourne's Centre for the Study of Higher Education. His honors there include the University of Melbourne's Woodward Medal in the Humanities and Social Sciences for his research on higher education and globalization, and an appointment as a lifetime fellow of the Society for Research into Higher Education in the United Kingdom. A native of Australia, he is the first Clark Kerr lecturer chosen from outside the United States. Today, his topic is Clark Kerr and the California Model of Higher Education. In the history of higher education and in the history of higher education in California, these lectures, this lecture today, and the other two that he will give could not be more timely lectures. So would you please join me in giving Professor Simon Markinson a warm welcome.
Thank you very much, Claude. That was a very nice introduction. And thank you, Judd, for all you've done for me too. I thank all those folk who called in an outsider, a scholar from an obscure country on the far side of the world, to be a golden bear for a week and to share in the gravitas of this lecture series with its great name. I doubt if I have much wisdom to add to what you know, but at least I've reduced the risk for you by moving to a less obscure country soon after receiving your kind of an invitation. I particularly want to thank John Douglas and Christine Hurd, who've facilitated our stay here. My wife, Anna Smolentseva, and our son, Sasha, are with us today. This lecture series is a settling challenge to those who are invited to participate. It invites us to consider our words with more than the usual care, to summon whatever it is, if anything, that might be distinctive in what we say, and to synthesise and conclude our thought about higher education, an enterprise populated by intelligent people of almost every possible description. Yet I accepted without hesitation. I always liked very much the uses of the university, and from the far side of the world, I saw Clark Kerr as an admirable man. The modern system and institution builders, those who created higher education in the 30 years after World War II, deserve all our respect. That generation includes my father, Raymond Marginson, the principal executive administrator at the University of Melbourne for more than two decades, still alive and active in university meetings at the age of almost 91. We work within the halls that were built by that generation, first in their minds and then in the world. Now, Clark Kerr was the foremost of the builders. For better knowledge of Clark Kerr and his works, I thank the scholars I've read in recent months, but especially John Douglas, Sheldon Rothblatt, and C.K. himself. Now, I begin by discussing the man in terms of the work. First, the 1960 Master Plan, the embodiment of what might be called the Californian model of higher education. Second, the 1963 Godkin Lectures. And then I move to two other scholars from the University of California, who, like Kerr, brought Californian thinking to the whole higher education world, Martin Trow and Burton Clark, or Bob Clark, as his colleagues called him. I did not meet Kerr, but I met Trow and I knew Clark. Each produced one work that is constantly read and cited. Then I want to open the apparent paradox that lurks at the back of all three lectures. The Californian model, or different versions and aspects of it, has swept across America and the world, becoming installed, at least in the idea, as the modern higher education system norm, in which access and excellence are both secured through diverse provision. Now, the excellence component, Kerr's Multiversity, the large comprehensive science university, is closely imitated in many countries. Yet in California, while the excellence component is still travelling well, I think, the model as a whole has faltered. It now seems too difficult to provide access and excellence on a common public basis. The conditions and drivers that sustained the 1960s model have changed. The model perhaps has changed less. Perhaps that's part of the problem. I'll close tonight by pointing the way to Lecture 2. Now, Clark Kerr. Clark Kerr is fortunate in his friends and colleagues. They say fine things about him. Sheldon Rothblatt says that he saw life clearly and he saw it whole, citing Matthew Arnold. He read widely, was learned, and had a wonderful capacity to ask good questions and find good answers. His observations were compelling. He spoke with clarity and direction, in sentences often pithy. Christina Gonzalez says he was intensely interested in ideas. It's a very flattering, I think. Very, very nice thing to say about an intellectual. Neil Smelser says he had an ability always to grasp the big picture, and he was down to earth. His visions were embedded in the realities of social, political, and economic life. For Pat Pelfrey, he had a singular ability to look at mountains of information and discern patterns and trends where others only saw a jumble of unrelated facts and statistics. Now, this social science imagination, with its patterns and trends, invoked for Kerr the structure-agency dilemma. As Rothblatt puts it, what remains of human freedom when the impersonal forces of history sweep all before them? Yet Kerr also had a gift for individual agency freedom. He respected talent and believed talented people should be given plenty of scope. His answer to the structure-agency dilemma, I think, was not either or, but both and more. Clark Kerr framed things for himself in such a way so that he could see the world whole and in its many parts and would be effective in action within it. As Sheldon Rothblatt describes it, Kerr's method was to pose contrasting poles of interpretation and then make synthetic judgments in the middle ground. Some would call this dialectical. Rothblatt makes the telling comment that Kerr saw the world in terms of in-betweens rather than absolutes. One example is his comment that the multiversity was both public and private and something more. He was not an ideologue, in other words. He wanted to encompass the complexity of the world, not to oversimplify it. For example, in the multiversity concept, the notion of multiplicity enables a more inclusive vision of the university. His leadership style paralleled his intellectual method. As UC president and then the head of Carnegie Commission, he led inclusively, by consensus. He believed mediation was the supreme function of leaders. The role of mediator was not to find the midpoint between the contending parties, but to articulate a higher agreement, a synthesis that addressed everyone's ideas or concerns and turned them into a new solution that all could endorse. This is a transformative form of mediation. Kerr had the audacity to seek transformative consensus because he was an optimist. He was an active Quaker in his youth who always saw good in every person or believed it could be found. He saw industrial civilization as inevitable and on the whole beneficial, but was sure the world could be made a fairer and kinder place. He opposed communism and was a critic of capitalism, which he saw in terms of in-between, as an amalgam of pluses and minuses. He supported public planning while conscious that states could be overbearing and legislatures were not always reliable. He lost faith in pure markets during the Depression, as so many did. He was a liberal New Dealer in politics and a Keynesian in economics. Perhaps he would have been uneasy about today's neoliberal ascendancy and today's foreign policies. He opposed American intervention in Vietnam because, as he stated, it was a bad war for Americans to be in. He was the national chair of the Anti-War Committee for a Political Settlement in Vietnam. Yet, at one stage, Lyndon Johnson had Kerr under consideration for the post of American ambassador to South Vietnam, so compelling were his public policy credentials. JFK had offered Kerr the post of Secretary of Labor. Kerr turned him down because he was working on the master plan. The post that Johnson did offer him in December 1964 was Secretary for Health, Education and Welfare. "You'll have more money to work with than anyone else has had in American history," said the President. To Johnson's surprise and annoyance, Kerr asked for time to think about it.
Berkeley was in the throes of the free speech movement. It was not a good time to walk away. Meanwhile, reports Seth Rosenfeld in his 2012 book Subversives, the president asked Herbert Hoover to do the usual background check of Kerr's character, associates and loyalty. And Hoover produced a misleading report, 12 pages, recycling allegations against Kerr that the FBI itself had dismissed. Kerr decided to stay with UC. At the same time in Washington, Johnson was withdrawing the offer. Kerr was too in between for Herbert Hoover and later for Ronald Reagan. But one suspects that Kerr's in-betweenness and its cousins, inclusion and multiplicity, were great strengths for him and for the master plan. The plan was not so much a plan as a bargain between the contending parties. As an industrial relations mediator, of course, Kerr liked bargains, but it was pitched for the long term. It was an inclusive Kerr-style, above it all, transformative bargain. The plan was a bargain between the university and the state colleges, later the Californian State University. The colleges gained coherence as a sector. The university protected its near monopoly of research and doctorates. This ensured such a thick distribution of research funding across the whole of UC system that 50 years later, 9 of the 10 campuses are listed in the world's top 50. It was also a bargain between higher education and the legislature. Backed by Governor Pat Brown, the plan meant the end of the open market approach of lawmakers and local communities towards creating new campuses, as Douglas puts it. Why did the state agree to close off its fiscal and political options? The larger answer, I think, lies in the political culture of the time. The late 1950s and the 1960s were an extraordinary time. I mean, perhaps the explosion of popular culture in the second half of the 60s has blocked from our view the all-around creativity in many spheres, among them research and higher education policy and government itself. It was the time of the Great Society and the greater civil rights movement. Both government and its critics wanted to make a better world and thought it could be achieved. Rothblatt states, the period was one in which the very idea of planning itself was held in high esteem. The memory of the Second World War was still green, sustaining the potential for big collective solutions. American society lay between the improvised plans, resource and population management of the war years, and the new civil society and the new individuality which was emerging. The Soviet Sputnik in 1957 had pushed sciences and universities up the agenda. In this context, a well-documented plan for higher education, one that promised shared opportunities for individual freedom and betterment in the national interest, had very broad appeal. The content of the plan tapped into an older tradition Douglas calls the Californian idea. This derived from the California Progressives, a middle-class political reform movement that set out to shape Californian society at the end of the 19th century. The progressives believed education would, to quote John, usher in a modern and scientifically advanced society. All high school graduates should have the opportunity for post-secondary training. The state should progressively expand the number of public higher education institutions, especially in emerging population centres. By 1920, there was a University of California on two campuses and two research stations, a large system of public junior colleges and the teachers' colleges. Berkeley President Benjamin Wheeler positioned the university as, in Douglas's words, a great engine of equality and prosperity for the state. The 1960 plan returns again to this tradition. It says that it guaranteed that there would be a place in college for every high school graduate or person otherwise qualified who chose to attend, as Kerr put it. In 1960, 45% of California's college-age population matriculated to a higher education institution. The national average was about 25%. The plan endorsed continued growth in participation in response to economic need and popular demand, which it seemed to conflate, and the equalisation of opportunity and the removal of access barriers. Now, as well as being normatively compelling, the master plan was economically cheap for the first 15 years because it shifted part of future growth from four-year to two-year institutions. Structurally, it firmly separated the elite research-intensive university from the volume-building community colleges and buffered by a middle sector located on the mass side of the divide because its potential in research and doctoral training was constrained. The plan was public in its commitment to universal access and in its systemic character. In the positioning of the sectors as interdependent, it replaced unbridled competition with cooperation between and within sectors, a major departure from the idea of the university as a standalone firm competing against all other firms in its business that was influential then and today is very compelling. The plan also sustained the long-term autonomy of higher education in this highly politicised state. Provided all sectors kept to the rules, higher education could more or less regulate itself, with the universities protected by the sector officers from the interference that plagues institutions in other states. This autonomy did not necessarily contradict the public character of the master plan. Higher education was positioned as a kind of civil society, separate from government, while universal and public. An alternate form of public, democratic in its purpose and access, but closed to electoral contest or political capture. This freed the multiversity to both do public good and to be itself, while holding it at the pinnacle of the system. Now, 3 years later, Clark Kerr put the seal on his understanding of the multiversity in the Godkin Lectures. The first three lectures are still the most insightful book on modern higher education, remarkable 51 years later, especially the large research university, the best explanation of the large research university still that we have. And it's not least because of this book that the research university has become the ideal and hegemonic form of higher education institution across the world. Now, Kerr's prose is not as beautiful as J.H. Newman's in The Idea of a University. I mean, Newman's extraordinary writing, it's just unbelievably beautiful, still compels us to a normative argument that's archaic and unrealistic, and it was even in its time, it is so today. For example, the refusals of research in university and refusals of practical knowledge against Bacon and refusals of learning for vocation. Now, Kerr compels us in a different way. He uses spare and simple prose, and he joins this to a pellucid clarity in analysis. He's not a humanist like Newman. He's a humanistic social scientist, at home with numbers but not ruled by them, lifting us with language while staying anchored in the material world. The observations are immediate, plausible, witty. They make our own experience more clear to ourselves. Clark Kerr's grasp of what Smelser calls the realities of social, political, and economic life was such that the uses of the university still stands as such a strong and valid description of the research university today. Now, as I said, I think in part it's because developments in California in 1960, such as the large university, professional administration, government structuring of research via funding, and the effects on the disciplines and so on, that anticipates developments which subsequently occurred in many other places throughout the world. And in part, I think the uses of the university remains relevant because Kerr saw where things were going. In part, it's because he was very strong at the level of generic concepts and synthesis, and those generic concepts still hold. And in part, I think it's a powerful book because he separated fact and value in the style of Weber. Now, as he stated in the 1963 preface, Kerr saw it as his task to explain the multiversity, how it worked, and the environment in which it sat, not to preach one or another normative position on what it should be. Explanation, in his view, had an honoured place. The separation between fact and value, of course, is never absolute. Explanation can be used to inform a range of normative projects, and Kerr's observations, of course, were shaped by his own values. Yet those values, I think, for him were also a partly open system. He knew that there was always more to learn. New facts, new explanations were possible. Different people had good ideas, and even values were open to tests of evidence and could evolve over time. By explaining the multiversity in realistic fashion, he opened it to a broader public scrutiny and created a more sophisticated reflexivity about institutional form. This has no doubt fed into the evolution of all research universities. Kerr later said that with hindsight, he would have been less frank less the social scientist, more guarded in the Godkin lectures. I paid a heavy price for being an honest and realistic commentator, he said. We're fortunate that it did not have hindsight, though we can sympathise with his predicament. The first Godkin lecture provides a history of ideas of the university, reflects on the American institution and its key moments, the land grant movement and research and graduate university that begins at Hopkins, and explains the multiversity as a plurality of communities, interests, agendas and beliefs, and reflects on governance and the different styles of presidential leadership, culminating in the president as mediator. Lecture 2 situates the multiversity in its federal policy setting. Research funding had created the federal grant university, though this role was more concentrated than the land grant role had been. Direct relations between granting agencies and disciplines had skewed the balances between fields and disembedded faculty stars and research centres from the multiversity. Research income compromised undergraduate teaching. Familiar issues, still with us. Lecture 3 expanded on both sets of themes. The two big shifts in higher education had been the adoption of the principle of universal access and the idea of progress through science, post-1945. The multiversity was seen as the driver of economic growth and had been burdened with the role of all-round solver of problems. It now included all students, regardless of their social and economic background. The faculty were conservative, and he talks about this for a few pages, but external factors that were driving change were irresistible. Growth, the spread of professional credentialing, university involvement in society. The knowledge industry was becoming central to business and government. Universities were becoming more like industry themselves. Resources were becoming concentrated in units that produced useful or saleable knowledge, stratifying the sector. Inter-university rivalry had become intense. Now, Kerr did not call it academic capitalism, but he described some of the signs, and well ahead of other commentators. There were three challenges ahead, as he saw it: to improve undergraduate instruction, to create a more unified intellectual world and with stronger humanities and social sciences, a theme he constantly refers to throughout his life, and to relate the administration more directly to faculty and students in the massive institution. No doubt, those challenges remain before us to solve. The Godkin lectures are a very good summary. Now, they failed to predict Silicon Valley and the internet, the wholesale offshoring of production in many industries, neoliberal policy. But no one else had predicted them either. My only reservation is about Kerr's account of the coherence of the institution. In the first Godkin lecture, Kerr remarks that the universities have a unique capacity for riding off in all directions and still staying in the same place. It's a wonderful image, isn't it? Later in the 2001 edition of the Uses of the University, and that last chapter is a very good chapter, he commented that the integration of the multiversity into the outside world triggers its tendencies to disintegration within. Now, both of those statements, to me, pose the question, what holds the multiversity together? What gives this structure its coherence? Given its many norms, missions, interests, pressures and inconsistencies, which he rightly identifies. Now, Kerr has various answers to this, I think, implicit and explicit. I mean, one answer was nothing. You know, nothing holds it together, sort of a postmodern answer, I suppose. Another answer was the university president holds it together. And I think that was certainly part of his thinking for a while. A third answer was the name of the multiversity holds it together. And he says this explicitly at one point. And I think that's nearer the mark. In my judgment, what holds the multiversity together, and remember we're talking about the elite research university here, is something Kerr doesn't talk about much directly, and that's social status. It's a concept that some sociologists use a lot and others don't use. I mean, in a modern age, it's hard to talk directly about status. It's got an aristocratic air about it, hasn't it? Research universities, I would argue, are a status economy. I mean, their institutional status is reproduced by their selective entry and their research performance. Now, these two drivers of status, selective teaching and research, tend to feed into each other. In elite universities, high-quality students bring status to the institution and they reproduce its selectivity. And in return, they receive institutional brand status as graduates. Though, of course, the value of those brands does tend to vary also by field of study, not just by institution attended. Now, in turn, the educational mission drives the accumulation of revenues needed to sustain research performance. And superior research lifts institutional status with its power to attract top students. So this is it, this circular process. This is the real teaching research nexus. It's articulated by status competition. And this is also, I think, the framework for a resource dependency logic in the multiversity. You have to, I think, to put the status factor into the equation to understand the peculiarities of this institution. Status is scarce. In the upper reaches of the sector, it's almost zero sum in the sense that there's only so much high prestige to go around, and that helps to explain the growing intensity of competition that Kerr noted. Now, at the lower levels of higher education, there is no status. Its binding effects are available only to institutions in the upper tier. So it's less clear what holds non-research institutions together, except, of course, that for-profits are held together by the desire for money. Now, I think this lack of binding status is one reason for the fragmentation of mass higher education, which I wanted to discuss in the second and third of these lectures. Now, I'll turn now to Martin Trobe, who talked directly about elite and mass higher education. Martin Trobe was a sociologist who directed the Berkeley Center for the Study of Higher Education from 1976 to 1988. In 1974, he produced a paper for OECD called Problems in the Transition from Elite to Mass Higher Education. The argument was prophetic, and it's influenced policy thinking in many countries. It's scarcely possible to overstate the impact of this argument. Now, Trow isolated three phases in the evolution of higher education. Elite higher education, mass higher education, where participation exceeds 15% of the age group, and universal higher education, when participation exceeds 50%. Access shifts from a privilege in the elite phase to a right in the mass phase to an obligation in the universal phase. You have to attend to have a good life. You have to go through higher education. The purpose of higher education shifts from shaping the mind and character of the ruling class in the elite phase to preparing a larger group in professional and technical skills in the mass phase to preparing the whole population in adaptability to social and technological change in the universal phase. These three phases of Weberian ideal types. Trobe various imagined them as historical stages and as differing sets of practices which could be occurring in the same period. The idea that they might be alongside each other allowed him to explain how elite institutions could flourish alongside mass and universal higher education. The three phases at the same time allowed Trobe, when he slips back into the idea of them as sequential phases, to develop narratives about change, and quite compelling narratives as they are in areas like teaching and student life and the organisation of higher education. For example, his narrative of the transition from Oxbridge-style tutorials in the elite phase to low-intensity teaching and technological delivery in the universal phase. And he might say anticipates MOOCs. Trobe's other achievement, and this I want to highlight, is that better than other social scientists of his day, he understood the drivers of the growth of participation in higher education. The dominant mythology, shaped by human capital theory, was this: economic growth and modernisation drives the need for more graduates. Individuals invest time and money in higher education in response to the opportunity for future earnings. Governments respond to both sets of signals, labour market demand and student demand for places, by expanding the supply of higher education. At times, expansion overshoots the mark and generates an oversupply of graduates. At times, there is a lag in meeting labour market needs and shortages result. But sooner or later, policy and or market forces will restore the equilibrium between education and the economy. So if that equilibrium is not there, then something is wrong, and it's probably in the education system. Now, most families see higher education first and foremost in terms of jobs and careers, I'm sure. And as Clark Kerr put it in 2001, in the United States, higher education has always been occupationally oriented. Hence the great growth since the mid-1970s in fields like business studies, technologies and engineering, and the partial eclipse of liberal studies. But do these expectations, these normal popular expectations, follow human capital logic? Does the causality flow from economic demand for labour to investment in education in terms of lifetime earnings, rates of return, to specific labour market outcomes? Do people calculate participation in in terms of net rates of return over a lifetime. Now, Trow does not share this dominant mythology. In Problems, he does not critique the human capital argument directly, but he uses a different framing of participation. While he noted that both the economy and graduate jobs were expanding, this was incidental to growth and the demand for places in higher education. The main driver of growth in participation was aspirations for social position. People invested time and money in higher education in order to augment their position, as human capital theory suggests, but most of them did so without knowledge of the specific outcomes of that investment. They knew only that whatever the state of the labour markets, it was better to be a graduate than a non-graduate. Thus, popular demand for higher education was not shaped by the logic of economic scarcity. It seems to me very unlikely, stated Trow, that any advanced industrial society can or will be able to stabilise the numbers. Despite loose talk about graduate unemployment or of an oversupply, stated Trow, it is still clear that people who have gone on to higher education thereby increase their chances for having more secure, more interesting and better paid work throughout their lives. As more people go to higher education, it becomes normalised. It develops into a universal aspiration. It becomes quasi-compulsory because, as I said, non-participants face a diminished life. And graduate unemployment is not a problem because of the educational inflation of occupations. In other words, graduate jobs are not a constant. Graduate jobs are not fixed in nature, but they move down the occupational scale while, when graduate numbers increase. Graduates displace those without college, sometimes using their educated capabilities to enrich the jobs. What mass higher education does is to break the old rigid connection between education and the occupational structure, quote. Now, that's not a human capital view of the world, and I think it's profoundly explanatory of the growth of participation. The crucial insight was that once mass higher education was established, social demand would expand until it approached universality, unless, and here the Californian model problems kick in, unless there were strong barriers, such as cost or low, strong cost barriers or low retention in the school system. Government would have to respond also to the social demand for places. Governments like to say we are creating opportunity, but in fact, governments respond to the demands from the middle class. In the first instance in California, of course, expressed through the electoral system. But the interesting thing is this, is that the same political logic plays out in other kinds of polities as well. It has become apparent around the world that social demand has the same limitless quality and the capacity to move governments to open the gate in democracies and in one-party states and in dynastic regimes as well. In the second Clark Kerr lecture, I will discuss what might be called the generic Martin Trow tendency, the universal tendency to universal higher education, and the way that is playing out across all over the world at the moment at a rapid rate, following the Californian logic. There are many signs Trow's reading of the employment-education relationship was right. There's a chronic lack of fit between higher education and the labour markets. It seems when it's presented and discussed publicly that it's a kind of pathology, a sort of thing that shouldn't be happening, but it happens again and again. While in elite professional fields there is a clear match between training and employment, I mean, for example, the number of medical graduates bears an approximation to the number of people who are employed as professional doctors. And while labour markets do pull additional educational supply in particular areas of shortage at particular times, for example, if there's a shortage of accountants or engineers, that does trigger a response in the education system. Now, on the whole, labour markets and education markets are on separate tracks, as Roger Geiger puts it. Employers are selected on the basis of many factors. Specific qualifications are only one. Institution attended can be equally important. Specialist graduates often go where the best opportunities lie rather than where the best pay and career prospects are for them rather than to the occupations for which they were exactly trained. In some countries, at least half the graduates from law and or engineering work outside those fields. More remarkably, many specialist positions are filled by persons trained in the wrong field. And you see this repeatedly. I mean, in any case, the majority of graduates are not tailored specifically for particular occupations. They're generic. They carry generic qualifications in business, humanities, social sciences, or natural science to maximise their range of opportunities. And this is consistent also with the fact that most jobs in management and government are also generic in character. It's foolish to berate educational institutions for not achieving a close fit between training and work. Graduate labour markets do not work like that. But I think that expectation is there. And I think it's one of the rods we've created for ourselves, for our own back, by implying that that's the promise that we can keep. Trost's perspective is not shared by many policy economists or editorial writers, but it does have some support from other scholars. I mean, in higher education and the world of work, Ulrich Teichler finds that a match between the number of graduates and corresponding positions, or between the competences acquired during study and job requirements, cannot be expected. Clark Kerr notes in 1967, there is no precise way to relate rising job content to higher educational requirements. Kerr saw the degree in generic terms. While its contribution to productivity was substantial, productivity was a bit of a mystery for social science, difficult to measure exhaustively. This suggests that the value of higher education is not going to be captured by private rates of return, certainly not exhaustively. Now let's turn now to the third of our Californian scholars, Bob Clark. Bob graduated from UCLA and worked at Stanford, Harvard, Berkeley and Yale, where he served as chair of sociology. He returns to UCLA as the Alan M. Carter Professor of Higher Education in 1980 and publishes his seminal, The Higher Education System, in 1983. Now, he develops a cultural understanding of the sector in that remarkable book. It sets out to explain how higher education is organised and governed, and it considers work, beliefs, authority, Weber again, system integration and the handling of change within systems and institutions. He explains the role of symbolic factors in higher education, the integrating role of shared beliefs and the different permutations of system structure. The book was grounded in a succession of empirical studies, not only here but in the UK, France, Italy, Germany, Japan and the Soviet bloc. Clark did not impose norms based on a solely American experience. The nuanced insights in the higher education system had broad worldwide purchase. They retain their relevance three decades later, though I think if the work was prepared today, it would probably say more about competition, university rankings, university brands as symbolic and integrating factors, and management and managed faculty behaviour. Interestingly, Clark Kerr, writing 20 years before, anticipated the entrepreneurial university more than did the higher education system. Although Bob went to that topic later in his book on the entrepreneurial university, which is a comparative study, in 1978. In 1998, in the earlier work, the higher education system, Bob does go further than Kerr and Trow in isolating what was distinctive about the higher education sector. Now, Clark has got a more bottom-up view, I think. It does not make much sense, he says, to evaluate business firms according to how much they act like universities, nor economic systems according to their resemblances to higher education systems. Nor does it make any sense to do the reverse. Yet it is built into current common sense and management theory that we should do so. The key to understanding higher education, he said, was the knowledge-centred nature of its tasks, which fostered a diversity of outlook and the autonomy of persons and groups, and endemic uncertainty and ambiguity. Centrality of knowledge was, quote, the root cause of the many odd ways of the higher education system. Now, I think that's a profound insight, and Kerr agreed that knowledge was central to explaining higher education. Bob took the discussion further. Now, on this point, though not on many others, Kerr and Clark both agree with J.H. Newman, centrality of knowledge. However, Bob Clark's work is best known for its triangle of coordination. Clark established three Weberian ideal types: systems driven by states, systems driven by market forces, systems driven by academic oligarchies, as he's called it. And he positioned all nations according to which point of the triangle they were closest to. This construction is still widely used, though I think it's proven somewhat vulnerable to history. Clark wrote his book before the full deployment of neoliberal systems of government, in which states deliberately deploy quasi-market forms as means of allocation, as means of control, legitimation, and performance management. In today's systems of coordination, in other words, two parts of his triangle, state and market, often overlap. Another problem is that in most countries, the authority of the university executive has partly replaced that of professors and faculty. And in some countries, but not others, that executive authority is tied to the state. Now, all that is going on inside one point of Clark's triangle, which is the academic oligarchy. So to encompass these complexities, you immediately start to make this beautiful, simple triangle almost unusable. So the triangle breaks down, but it's a brilliant simplification, and nothing has really replaced it. So it's still quite influential. So Clark Kerr, Martin Trow, and Bob Clark, three Californians, the three most influential thinkers in the academic field of higher education studies worldwide. Only Ulrich Teichler from Germany comes close. My doctoral students continue to seek out Kerr, Trow, and Clark without prompting. Their worldwide influence in thought parallels the influence of the Californian model and the multiversity in system and institutional design. Well, let's return now to the Californian model. I like this. I love this map because Berkeley's the biggest place in it. It's the kind of capital of the state. universities. Let us return now to the model. A self-regulating system continually expands to meet social demand while providing for economic need. A system approach with an ordered and hierarchical division of labour based on defined missions, sustaining access while protecting the elite research sector and maintaining the reproductive social order, not disturbing the balances too much. Values of openness, optimism, public-spiritedness and common enterprise. All Californians free to pursue their goals and dreams, their careers and earnings and riches by using public education. An attractive vision. But now everything has changed, it seems. The Californian model has run into sand. For an outsider, it's a little astonishing. How did it happen? It's often argued that the decline of the Californian model began with the free speech movement in 1964, a year after the uses of the university. In 1960, Clark Kerr had predicted a new bohemianism composed of a greater degree of personal liberty and individualism. How accurate that was. He was right, but I don't think he understood the student revolt. Though some activists were reading Marcuse's One Dimensional Man, the demonstrations were not primarily about alienation, as Kerr thought. Rather, the students' confrontations with authority expressed their collective desire for a new and very alternate society. This desire drove the rise of the counterculture 3 years after the free speech movement began. The multiversity was both the incubation chamber for this sustained creative experiment and its collateral damage. The student revolt did not disrupt the Californian model, but it weakened the position of the multiversity in mainstream Californian political culture. The real disaster for the Californian model was the tax revolt, which began with Proposition 13 in 1978. Ironically, the communal individualism of the new left paved the way for the high capitalist individualism of the new right. The anti-statism of a movement against the war and the draft morphed into the anti-statism of the tax revolt. Perhaps some of the same people were involved. The Californian model was a public policy that created long-term social conditions for individual freedom. In lifting the rights of each person, it lifted the condition of all people. But the mad belief embodied in Proposition 13 that government tax spend is in itself a reduction of liberty, a reduction of individual liberty, is incompatible with public provision. I mean, there's no basis on which you can fund common public enterprise once you accept the proposition that tax spend is a reduction in individual liberty. It's still surprising for this outsider that this same mad belief remains a potent factor in American politics and is rarely challenged at the root. You know the story from there. I mean, Proposition 13 reduced county revenues by 40% and undermined K-12 and community colleges. So in 1988, Proposition 98 tied 40% of the state budget to K-12 and community colleges. And the UC and CSU were locked into the small part of the budget where the state still had discretion. I think it was about 15% once you took everything else into account. And Clark Kerr noted in 1994 that Californian higher education experienced much the largest cuts of any state. He quotes a state budget official, "It was a war of knives. Higher education had no knife." But the early 1990s have been dwarfed by the effects of the recession since 2008. A catastrophic drop in revenues meets an unsustainable fiscal system. In the last decade, state funding to UC has been cut by a third. So the model cannot be funded under its old terms at a universal level. At the same time, and against the trend line in most of the world, democratic participation in schooling and higher education has faltered amid major social inequalities, again undermining the public character, its universality of the model. In California, only 2/3 of public high school students graduate. I was very surprised when I saw that figure. There are very high graduation rates in wealthy neighbourhoods and dismal rates in low-income communities. In 2007, Los Angeles United School District had a completion rate of 41%. Transfer rates from the Californian community colleges to four-year institutions also vary dramatically by region. Quality of community colleges varies dramatically by region. You know the ethnic composition of low participation and low transfer populations. A declining financial capacity in higher education meets staggering school retention ordered in an ethnic hierarchy. The outcome is not very pretty. Despite the poor throughput from school level, cash-starved higher education can no longer cope with the flow it gets. Eligible students are being turned away from the UC system and state universities. The community colleges, most seriously, the community colleges can no longer expand to accept all demand. Though the system relationships are maintained and the president's office still buffers the UC campuses from direct legislative interference, and that's a significant gain, participation has lost its universal character and California has lost national leadership. Whereas in 1960s, state participation was almost double the national average, 50 years later, in 2010, California was the 43rd state in the proportion of 18 to 24-year-olds with baccalaureate status. In the US as a whole, the proportion of the population graduating with a degree has fallen in relative terms to be only slightly above the OECD average. And the OECD average includes some low performers. You might say the nation is still following the trends in California, but California is, as ever, is more extreme. There will be a dramatic surge in population in the state in the next generation, though. I mean, the state will have 50 million people in 2050 compared to 38 million in 2013. So what will happen then to the structures of the plan? And can California respond to the challenge with a new master plan crafted for a different time? If so, it will be necessary to go back to first principles. We cannot divorce the question of the university from the question of society, any more than did Clark Kerr and Martin Trow. The root problems lie in the social and political culture. The public-private balance has shifted. A more self-centred individualism is dominant. And in higher education, an instrumental economic focus has so strengthened the emphasis on private individual rewards as to exclude the notion of the common good. The system is nominally public, and it does some very public things still, like, for example, progressive tuition policy in the UC system, but it does not serve everyone. It no longer serves everyone. In a more competitive setting, equality of opportunity is thwarted, though I think the 1960s abstract expectations about equality were unrealistic. And I think that part of the rethinking is to rethink that problem. In Lecture 3, I'll return to these themes. I suggest two moves that might be made to renovate the public mission of the multiversity and the Californian model, and to offer you gratuitous outsider advice on what a new Californian model might contain, knowing I can skip away and take no responsibility for the politics of trying to implement it. Let me just say this now. The Californian model always was historically specific. It needed to evolve more than it did to enlarge itself, to encompass growth, and perhaps to lift the level of participation as the threshold of participation was moving up, and to change itself to respond to changing publics and demographics, and, of course, to repair the internal deficiencies that arise in any strong public structure like that. There's no return to 1960 or 1963 any more than there is a way back for JFK from Dallas. As Clark Kerr put it in the 1963 preface to the Godkin Lectures, instead of platitudes and nostalgic glances backward to what it once was, the university needs to take a rigorous look at the reality of the world it occupies today. As for the multiversity, so for the Californian model. But there is more to Californian higher education than the travails of state policy and taxation. For the forms and ideals of the Californian model and the multiversity has spread across the whole world in a globalised setting. The second lecture will discuss the global higher education space, which is evolving quickly, and the articulation of the model through diverse political cultures. In that global space, there are strategic opportunities, new kinds of private and public, new potentials for reciprocity, new potentials for ourselves to change, and foreign policy challenges, and perhaps some of the seeds for the next Californian Renaissance in higher education. I thank you kindly for sharing the lecture and look forward to some discussion. Thank you.
Well, it struck me in your very instructive exposition to remind myself that the major spokespeople and designers of the master plan and apologists for it were either sociologists, in the case of Tro and Clark, or institutional economists, which is somewhat sociological in its orientation, in the person of Clark Kerr. And it struck me further that some of the unsolved riddles that you identified in the course of your remarks might have been looked at if you'd brought an anthropologist in on one side, dealing with the distinctive culture of campuses and states, and the phenomenon of tribalism, which is surely one of the sources of great integration. In other words, your issue, unanswered issue of what holds things together. You might have looked a bit at the anthropological side of things. And then on the other side, your representative analysts are political science is absent on the other side. And there's a completely distinct political dimension of higher education, which is constantly in controversy, constantly debated by politicians and others as to what it ought to be doing, and constantly under attack. And these kinds of dimensions don't really show up in the fundamental analysis that your three people put forward.
I think that thanks very much for the comment. I think the cultural anthropological side is very good point, and I think Bob Clark is dealing with that. He's attempting to deal with variations. He doesn't use the full set of kit that the anthropologist has. But he knows he needs to get there. I think, he's working towards that. But I think your comment's right. I'm really struck by the way that a particular kind of social scientist does this sort of work very well. I think the sort of person who can do this very well has that kind of capacity for synthesis, almost the capacity of an historian to synthesize an overview, but at the same time is good working the detail, can handle the numbers and can get close to things empirically and understands how you do that. And has that kind of intellectual discipline and rigour. And Kerr obviously has that joint set of tools, but others also were exercising that. It seems that in terms of political science in that period, Baldrige, his Power and Conflict in the University, that book was quite influential, and it's one that that Kerr refers to, and that's the notion of that the university can be understood in terms of competing interests. I'm not sure. I mean, I like that book a lot. I actually did my first thesis on that, on that book. It's one of my connections to Kerr, I suppose. I think a sort of interest group conflict model maybe isn't adequate to encompass the student revolt and probably isn't adequate to understand, for example, the politics of access, contemporary politics of access in California either. You need something with more stretch, than that notion that everyone can be categorised in terms of conflicting interests. But I think your point about political science is quite right.
Yes, we do have a microphone that comes to you.
To ask your question. It's a very good start. I really liked it. It's a wonderful start. Neil and I have actually talked about what holds this place together from time to time. And we start our conversation and then we go off somewhere on a tangent, which is what a university is all about. It's about tangents. But there is, there was a discussion that we were having in the center about this, and someone said, well, there is a common commitment across all the disciplines here at Berkeley, and it is towards excellence. Okay, that was an interesting idea. We didn't get off the ground, but this notion that there is something common to all the disciplines here that we are seeking, that is to push them to their very finest levels. An interesting idea. There are also, here again, what would we call this, Neil, you know, as a historian, you know, this business about sociologists and some political scientists get quite difficult for me. But there is this question of how the institution is actually structured and composed. There has been, across the 10 campuses, there really has been a historical attempt to provide some kind of unity. Now, Clark Kerr, you remember, said the only unity was the faculty had was a grievance over parking, a famous remark. But we have an academic senate which has one senate for the entire system. Then it's divided into divisions. The divisions divided into lots of committees. On those committees, people from a great variety of disciplines meet one another, friendships form, and discussions of some kind take place. So I'm wondering if one could factor into kind of an analysis of the institution, these internal factor of attempting to create bonding institutions in the form of more personalized interaction in a system that gets increasingly, bureaucratic, let's use the word, okay? Mm-hmm. It's increasingly large, bureaucratic, some say now even too large. So this might be an interesting way to look at the institution, because I think the committee structure is really important at Berkeley. Do you think?
So I think that creates some interesting possibilities for further research. But for me, because I'm now discovering, as I have in my conversations with people in the last 2 days, more about the institution, the UC institution, and how it works. I'm quite struck by the point, for example, that there's only one academic senate. I didn't realise that. I thought there would be separate senates as a matter of course.
Yeah.
But there is a holding operate, yeah, a single senate. I mean those integrative structures are really significant, I think, because they allow people to share, you know, the common commitment to excellence, as you say, in different ways, and to talk to each other about what they're doing. But the danger always is that under time pressure, under performance pressure, resource shortages and so on, that's the thing that gets set aside, that those integrating conversations get lost and people just burrow away in their own fields and carry a larger workload in their own place, and they lose that time and effort involved in keeping in touch with each other. So you have to work quite hard institutionally to maintain those structures, as you do with shared governance in general. You have to work quite hard to make, because it isn't a natural form in some ways, just in the multiversity. It was in its predecessor, but it's not. It's you've really got to work hard to hold it up. But Kerr seemed to be very good at a lot of informal and cut-across networking. If you've got a leadership which is extremely well networked horizontally and vertically across the institution and across different fields, I mean that, and across, and between its the different major institutional centres within the institution, that is another integrating factor, of course. I mean, a leadership ought to be able to do that. I think that's what we can reasonably expect. Although it's a very tough job to do it well because of the time constraints.
Next here, and then I think we'll go up top after that.
Your introducer suggested that the plan had become ragged, at least around the edges or a bit. A stronger thesis would say counterproductive. By holding back the next level of institutions from rising up. If we look at other parts of the country where this planning system was not into effect, for example, the Boston area, we've seen the rise of second and third tier institutions to first tier status. Not only Harvard and MIT as leadership institutions of 50 years ago, but now Boston University, Northeastern, Brandeis, the University of Massachusetts Boston now has PhD programs as well. They have positioned that region to take future economic leadership by having the strongest knowledge base in the country. At this point in time, this region has the strongest high-technology economic base. But will this hold if we hold back the next level of institutions from rising up in the same way that they have in Boston? So my thesis is that Boston may retake Silicon Valley and be the leading high-tech center of the world unless we revise drastically the plan and put both public and private resources. It's well known that the major corporations in Silicon Valley invest virtually nothing in higher education. The president of De Anza College, the leading community college, who supplied, his institution supplied, the talent to build the valley, was so frustrated that he finally said that he could not understand why Apple did not support that college. But even with this expression of frustration, he still got no results. And we have not seen these resources put into higher education in this part of the country the way they are in other places. So what is your take? Still valid or need for a rethink?
I mean, I can see the issue that you're... I mean, we can make various claims about what would happen under different scenarios, and there's a lot of guesswork in all that, of course. But there is I can see the substantial issue, which is the question of, you know, how many doctoral universities does the state sustain in the longer term? And this is the issue which is not usually discussed here, I have to say. I mean, the issue that I have been discussing with people a lot has been renovating the community colleges and ensuring the CSU are on track and so on as an important part of the mix. And I think everyone will agree with that, particularly the community colleges. But there is also the issue of whether 10 campuses, 10 institutions, if you like, is an adequate provision of doctoral education for a state the size of California. I mean, I think that's a very legitimate question. And if you look at the ratios of doctoral universities to population around the world, you'd probably say 1 to 2 million is the usual number for a university. And in this state, it's a little bit larger than that. So that's interesting. And when the population gets bigger, you know, that number gets even larger. So there is a question there. But there's a lot of things at stake here. And I don't simply mean the institutional interests. I mean, there's a lot of things in terms of quality and public provision. The model has got all kinds of problems now, but it's been very good at developing, sustaining world-class research universities. I mean, this is an astonishing state in terms of the quality and quantity of the quality of research science and professional training and liberal provision. The total number of students involved, the amount of research involved, and it's not uniform. The campuses are not uniform. They're not forced into a mould. But the only rule really is that they all have to be good. And the interdependency structures ensure that happens. And this is quite an achievement, and a lot of places around the world would kill for that outcome, that kind of strength of system. But there is a question about its enlargement. I don't think it can be avoided. I don't think, you know, there's only been one new institutional site in this period of the master plan, and that's not very many. So there is an issue. And, of course, that takes you back to the CSUs and what happens to them longer term. I know. I mean, I think that's... But you know, there's two possibilities. One is that the interdependency and the system structure is sustained but expanded. And it'll take quite some time for other sites to raise themselves to Riverside's level of achievement, for example. You know, it would take quite some time. The other option is you create the free-for-all. You take the break, you know, you break all the system links and you say, okay, it's an open market. We're going to treat it like an economy. It's an open market, free competition, it's a virtue, and so on, and we'll let that rip and see what happens, and of course that'll lead to better outcomes, but it won't necessarily. That's where you've got to be very, very careful, because it may not. It may lead to worse outcomes. I mean, at Berkeley, clearly Berkeley can go it alone and go it alone very successfully and probably strengthen its position overall in the world if it does. Be more competitive vis-a-vis the privates. But I don't think that will be the case for the others necessarily, all of them. UCLA presumably could do that, but not necessarily the others. And that's a big loss. So you've got to think about what goes up and what goes down as well and try and work out what the most likely outcome would be. But I think the system model is a prize, and of all the things that have, you know, all the problems that the California model has, I think the problem, the basic problem is the democratic problem, that there's not enough retention and participation in education. The state isn't universally committed to this system. Why would they pay taxes if they're not participating? You know, there's that bottom line problem. That's the big problem to address. And I think the problem of what happens at the other end, the elite end, while there is an issue there, and the issue you take up is a worthy and important debate and discussion to have, it's probably not as great as the first, I think.
I do understand with the map there that, and the thrust of the lecture, that this is about California and the Californian public system. But Professor Magenson, using your status as a professor in international higher education, my question is that do you think that the ideas of Clark Kerr and the debates about the public system of higher education in the Californian model have some relevance for a large country like India, which has many of the issues that you talk about, issues that stir the debates around the university system, issues, you know, the foremost of these would be the demographic pressure. The other issues, of course, it's a country which is in toil. It's kind of broken off from its initial moorings and leanings towards trying to set up a university model in the country which was pegged towards the British. It looked towards the, that system. But since the 1990s, you know, the country has been deregulating itself. And as the dirigiste model or the command and control model has been lowering down, it's been looking towards the US. I find it surprising that many elements of the California model, for example, the equality of opportunity, the access issues, all of these issues, the necessity to have greater public access, the need for greater community level colleges, as well as having you know, good quality research universities, all of those issues are right there on the Indian terrain. But what I look at as the country looks towards the US to be able to reorient its national university systems, it talks more in the language of an academic entrepreneurialism and academic capitalism, which has very little of California in it. I mean, there would be much of the world-class university type, you know, but very little of the flagship being spoken about on there. So I do want you to reflect somewhat that having very similar challenges and an acute demographic challenge, you know, right by our side, why is it that, you know, a country like India, which has been debating with issues of equality of opportunity in very specific ways and has a very strong tradition of, you know, hammering on these issues in politics at the national as well as at the federal state level, yet when it comes to institutional choices, it's talking more in a language which is so entrepreneurial and so capitalist that even Indian academics are unable to believe that that could be the direction of the university.
You know, if you can get me started on this topic, I could go for the rest of the night. India is a big discussion. As I mean, I'm going to talk mostly about China in 2 days, but we might talk about India again in on Thursday and do come along to that session. I've a number of quick points because I think that you know, time is probably now pressing. You know, it is of course interesting to contrast China and India because China's developing this phenomenally successful system, really, and increasing participation and the quality of the institution at the same time, and building high science at a very rapid rate and improving the quality of that very rapidly as well. Well, India was talk, you know, about the knowledge economy and the R&D revolution, and there is money being spent, especially in research, but. You know the problem. I mean, it's a different state to the East Asian state. It's a federal system. It's a highly politicised one, but not particularly good at implementation at the moment in this area. You have strong states in terms of provision. You have weak states, and there's very little real will at the moment to try to bridge those differences. The great bulk of participation is being carried by small private colleges, which are essentially obsolete as a model, an average size of 600. How many? 25,000 private colleges, enormous number. Some say 30. And it's not even properly regulated. No one really knows. Quality, of course, is just... there's no regulatory handle that can get a purchase on that, on quality of that sector. You've got the institutes of technology that are basically... position themselves as high quality institutions, but essentially achieve that by keeping their student numbers low and having an enormous number of people apply. So they're selecting very, very good students. And in some cases, they are developing research and doing interesting things, but essentially that's a lazy model. I don't think it's as good as it's cracked up to be. Then there's the conventional research universities, which are many in the public sector, which some of which, of course, have great prestige, but, you know, highly politicised, haven't been through the agony of modernisation reforms that we've all been through in the way we have, and most unproductive when you look at the research outputs. And you know, teaching models are very variable. I mean, the country's still groping for a way to coordinate, to address the issues overall. My friend Pawan Agarwal in Delhi works on these issues of trying to, you know, develop a national agenda. I think India will get there because there's so much resources, so much, I guess, momentum in the country in its modernisation phase with the process of urbanisation, with the enrichment of the economy developing, with the middle class, you know, in the end, will demand more coherent solutions to this problem because the education is so central and so important to many Indian families. So in the long term, it has to work out, but it isn't quite clear what the roadmap is at this point of time. Many, many issues to talk about India.
One last question.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you for this. It was an excellent talk. I wondered if you could reflect just a little bit more about the sort of historical grounding of Clark Kerr's vision for the system and for Berkeley in particular in the political economy that he was trying to supply knowledge workers to. Knowledge workers is a term that Clark Kerr doesn't coin but emerges out of this exact same time period. I believe it comes 1959 with Peter Drucker. Clark Kerr is writing and envisioning the university as an engine to supply a modernizing economy. So it's also interesting that we hear about this from India. And it's a particular vision of industrialization that is driven by technocratic elites and large institutions that are going to employ people who are knowledge workers coming out of all three levels of the system, being automatically slotted in a somewhat Huxleyan model where there's going to be alpha workers and beta workers coming out of different parts of the system.
I think,
And I think part of the revolt against Kerr and Kerrism that happens in the 1960s is a revolt against that kind of a model as the economy and the political economy and the culture of the political economy is changing. And one of the reasons why it seems to me that the master plan is fraying now is that the model, which made a lot of sense for the modernizing economy of the 1950s, was perhaps brilliantly conceived as a vehicle for furnishing knowledge workers for that economy, strikes me as being not particularly appropriate to the model of capitalism and industrial production that we have today. And this is why, you know, Apple Computer just blows off the local community college. They have no interest in that. They can recruit workers from all over the world, including from the IITs in India. So it seems to me that the model no longer makes sense given the structure of the economy today. And I don't know, I mean, maybe this is forecasting your fourth lecture, but I'd be interested in hearing you reflect on it a little bit now.
Well, just a few points. I mean, I think your comments are very good. I mean, Kerr's right where he says that his vision of the relationship between education and the economy was dependent on continuing high productivity growth. I mean, that's, you know, the point he comes back to when he explains why the relationship has become more fraught. I think that's, though, that this is one point where higher education systems haven't changed very much and where they're all in some difficulty. Because the structure, the internal structuring of systems where it differentiates between institutions with different missions and essentially arranges them in a Huxleyan hierarchy, you know, of research-intensive, high-quality universities that produce the top-end professional training, and the middle-level institutions where people are being prepared for more localised employment with some mobility, and the bottom-level institutions where their options are purely local. And the Dutch system, for example, with its dual university system, with its, you know, high-quality research universities as they are producing global knowledge workers and professionals, and its HBOs, its HBOs, explicitly their mission is local employment. And I just wonder, you know, whether we should want to talk about the distinction between those who are mobile, globally mobile, and those who are locally fixed. I mean, there's some human rights issues about that. There's certainly an abrogation of citizenship there. But it's not particularly a good description of how even middle-level trained knowledge workers are now working. I mean, they're not necessarily working locally, as you just said, in relation to Apple, they have to move where the jobs are, and that doesn't, and that breaks the local tie. So I think that, yeah, and this is, yeah, as you say, this is where the community colleges are in difficulty. So, I mean, I think that, you know, the great schism in our contemporary environment, which is so universal in so many ways, especially in relation to culture and communication, the great schism is between those who have the full options of mobility and those who don't. And I think those issues are really underdeveloped in Kerr's argument. But Niels knows his industrial sociology better than I do, and I think he's delved into these areas further than I have. And perhaps your question also prompts me to think a little bit further about what I'll say next week. Thanks.
I want to say thank you to Simon, which I will do so. I want to invite you to come to the second and third lectures, which are next Thursday and next Tuesday. And finally, I would like to invite you to a reception outside, which is an opportunity to mix with our speaker and with one another. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.